headlines for this hour. The World Health Organization says there are no more functional hospitals in North Gaza as the death toll from Israel's genocide tops 20,000. A rights advocacy organization says Israel's onslaught on Gaza is the most dangerous situation for journalists, with most journalists killed in a single year in one location. And the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has targeted a major port in the occupied Palestinian territories in response to the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Thank you for joining us. Nothing is more synonymous with barbarism than targeting civilians, women and children in particular. This is what Israel has been doing in the Gaza Strip since the regime launched its war of genocide on the Palestinian territory on October the 7th. More than 20,000 civilians, including more than 8,000 children and over 6,000 women, have been killed in the regime's attacks so far. The latest deadly strikes hit residential areas across the Gaza Strip, including the southern cities of Rafah and Khan Yunis. Nearly 30 people were announced dead following a Thursday bombing of the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Palestinian officials say many more people are now under the rubble. Hospitals are also amongst Israel's main targets, where the atrocious crimes of the regime are particularly noticeable.
We work in this place daily. There is nothing more difficult. Working here every day, we receive the shock of seeing the martyrs before their own parents. We encounter dismembered bodies, torn limbs and remains. We encounter the sights resulting from the airstrikes, the smell of bombardment, the smell of gunpowder, the smell of blood. We endure the initial and most horrific sights before they are endured by the parents of the martyr. When we encounter a tiny child without a head, little children without feet, without hands, small children reduced to dismembered body parts, then we feel very sad. It is a shock. It takes us hours to recover the psychological balance, to recover from the effects of this shock.
Israel's relentless strikes have knocked Gaza's medical facilities out of service. The territory's health ministry says the health system in the north of Gaza has been, quote, liquidated. The World Health Organization has also announced that there are no longer any functional hospitals in the northern part of the Palestinian territory.
Now, Al-Ahli is a shell of hospital. Until 2 days ago, it was the only hospital where injured people could get surgery in northern Gaza, and it was overwhelmed with patients needing emergency care. But there are no operating theaters anymore due to the lack of fuel, power, medical supplies, and health workers, including surgeons and other specialists. It completely stopped functioning and is only operating as a hospice currently with no or very little care. There are actually no functional hospitals left in the north. Al-Ahli was the last one, but is now minimal functional. And still treating patients, but not admitting new ones, along with Al-Shifa, Al-Ada, and Al-Sahaba Hospital. WHO will keep striving to supply health facilities in the northern Gaza, but without fuel, staff, and other essential needs, medicines, it won't make, medicines won't make a difference. And all patients will die slowly and painfully.
Various UN agencies have painted a harrowing picture of hunger in the besieged Gaza Strip as Israel continues its brutal aggression against the Palestinian territory. The UN's hunger monitoring system says Gazan households are facing the highest level of food insecurity and hunger that it has ever recorded globally. The Integrated Food Security Phase classification added in its report that the most likely scenario in Gaza is that by February the 7th, its entire population would be at a crisis or worse levels of hunger. The report said there is a risk of famine in Gaza if the current situation continues. The World Food Programme also weighed in on the report, saying it's indicative of the devastating situation in Gaza.
So, essentially, this report sort of confirms our worst fears in terms of the really truly devastating situation. which Gaza is experiencing right now. Pretty much all 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation. About 577,000, meaning more than 500,000 people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving.
The World Health Organization also raised the alarm about the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. The WHO said hunger is ravaging Gaza and this is expected to increase illness across the territory. It added that disease and hunger will lead to more deaths in Gaza. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has released new footage showing three Israeli captives held in Gaza and killed in the regime's airstrikes. The Al-Ghassan Brigade spokesman said the captives were killed despite efforts to preserve their lives. Abu Ubaidah said Israel must stop its onslaught to get its captives alive. He said Israel needs to accept the conditions put forward by the resistance. Abu Ubaidah added that Israel's objective to eliminate Hamas in Gaza was doomed to fail. The regime's military has killed Hamas-held captives on several occasions. It has confirmed the killing of at least three captives in Gaza during the ground offensive since early October. The Israeli military has said troops mistook the captives as threats and shot them dead. Israel's onslaught on Gaza has taken a heavy toll on journalists that cover the regime's bloody aggression against the besieged territory. Now, a US-based rights advocacy organization says the Israeli aggression on Gaza is the most dangerous situation for journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists says the first 10 weeks of the regime's genocide were the deadliest recorded ever for journalists, with the most journalists killed in a single year in one location. It also expressed concerns over what it described as an apparent pattern of targeting journalists by the Israeli regime. The CPJ says this issue, along with intense bombardment of Gaza, has prevented foreign journalists from independently accessing the situation in Gaza. Nearly 70 reporters and media workers have been killed since Israel's onslaught on Gaza started on October the 7th, 61 of them Palestinian. The regime has been also deliberately killing journalists' families who serve as a source for investigators looking into how those journalists died. Social media giants have been systematically silencing pro-Palestine voices during Israel's ongoing onslaught on Gaza. Their biased approach has been criticized by human rights groups that say the censorship is furthering the erasure of Palestinian suffering. We were joined earlier by author and activist Lucas Gage, who has faced such restrictions.
So I've been posting several things that have been pushing the limits of free speech. I've been pissing off the Israelis. I've been talking about things that, can offend some people, allowing this free speech to occur. And the Zionists had enough of me. So they started to mass report my accounts, calling me anti-Semite, Nazi, white supremacist, Jew hater, yada, 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 the same old spiel. They actually have a picture of a bunch of us, the people that I work with. They X'd me out because I eventually got banned today. And there are things that I said that, could offend some people, but I got banned for a rant that I made about Jewish supremacists, Zionism, this kind of thing. And they took my rant out of context, saying that I want to kill Jewish people, when in the next sentence I explain all you need to do is shame these Zionists and Jewish supremacists, call them out and show them what they're doing, laughing at children, making fun of people here, wanting more death and destruction. I mean, if you look at X, all these Zionist accounts are calling to level Gaza. There are no innocents in Gaza. James Woods, an actor, said, kill them all. They're not making any differentiation between civilians or not. So there are people like us and my side saying, we got to free Gaza. We got to help the Palestinians. And so I pushed the limits back to these people, and they decided to terminate me. And so it just goes to show that even X is being affected by this. We thought it was Facebook, Meta, Instagram, but even X is being pressured by Zionist lobbies and power. And we know that Elon Musk went to Israel, and he's got a dog tag on him. He's like, bring the hostages back, the whole nine yards of propaganda that he's fallen for, hook, line, and sinker. And we're seeing that reflection now. So I was a very big account. a very big thorn into the Zionist entity, and they didn't like me much, so they all flagged everything possible.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it has attacked the port of al-Rashrash in the occupied territories in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. The Iraqi resistance says it struck its target in the port city, which is known in Israel as Eilat, with appropriate weapons. It added that the operation was carried out in response to Israel's massacre of Palestinian civilians, including women and children, in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has already carried out a number of attacks on the occupied port city. It has also targeted major American military bases in Syria and Iraq during the past months in response to the U.S. support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. New clashes have taken place between Hezbollah and Israel along Lebanon's southern border. Hezbollah has launched a drone strike on an Israeli military position in the occupied Shebar Farms. The regime's military positions in the Margaliot area have also been targeted with rockets. Our Beirut correspondent joined us earlier with more details.
So we have definitely seen that the Israelis are taking steps that are not acceptable by the resistance. And so therefore we see that Hezbollah is stepping up their operations. Today, of course, we had several operations. There were at least seven operations. Two of them were conducted in the middle of the night in response to the targeting and the killing of a civilian. Today also we had the martyrdom of a civilian woman in the town of Marun Ar-Ras. We have her husband is severely injured. The resistance specifically retaliated for this, naming the woman in person. They directly said that this is in retaliation when they targeted the Kiryat Shmona camp. But you also have something new, which is the fact that Hezbollah said that they will be reciprocal when it comes to how they target things. So if the Israelis target a civilian house, they will try to also destroy the settlements. We've seen that in Motilin also today, and the fact that they also targeted a Merkava tank. We also saw that Hezbollah used drones today again to target gatherings of soldiers in towns that are Aviv and Doviv, which are considered the occupied Lebanese town of Salha.
Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations has warned against any provocative actions by Israel, saying such moves could seriously impact peace and security in West Asia. Amir Saeedi Ravani was addressing a UN Security Council meeting on the situation in Syria. He condemned Israel's frequent attacks against the Arab country. Iravani said the regime is engaged in terrorism and aggression within Syrian borders and internationally targets civilians and critical infrastructure. Iran's UN envoy urged the Security Council to condemn Israel's strikes on Syria.
Iran called on the Security Council to condemn the destabilizing activities of the Israeli regime and its severe violation of Syrian sovereignty and territorial integrity, which pose a threat to peace and stability in the region.
Iravani said it's Syria's inherent right under international law to take all necessary measures in response to Israel's terrorist attacks and acts of aggression. Iran's envoy also lashed out at the US and the UK for accusing the Islamic Republic of destabilizing West Asia. Iravani stressed that Iran has consistently demonstrated its commitment to promoting peace and security in the region. He also condemned the United States' unlawful military presence in Syria.
The security situation in areas controlled by illegal foreign forces and under occupation is a matter of serious concern. The primary source of insecurity is unlawful presence and continued occupation of U.S. military forces, creating an environment conducive to the growth of the terrorist activities within Syria and the broader region. The United States is fully responsible for its decade-long aggressions along with other crimes and unlawful measures in our region.
The Iranian diplomat also touched upon Israel's brutal war in the Gaza Strip and denounced the regime's atrocities there. Iravani harshly criticized the U.S. for vetoing all U.N. Security Council resolutions that called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Obstructing the Security Council from fulfilling its charter-based duties to establish a ceasefire and to stop the Israeli war machine against the people of Gaza for more than 2 months has called in doubt the U.S. real concerns about the spillover of the tension and peace and security in the region.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian visited Qatar for 2 days, where he held talks with his Qatari counterpart, as well as the leader of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Farzana Ashurian reports from Doha.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian traveled to Qatar in his fourth visit since Israel's onslaught on Gaza began over 70 days ago. He met with his Qatari counterpart, Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani, discussing bilateral ties as well as recent developments in the region.
We talked about the Palestinian issue. We also discussed bilateral relations between Iran and Qatar, including political and economic ties.
During his visit, Amir Abdollahian also met with the leader of Palestine's Hamas resistance movement, Ismail Haniyeh, to discuss a possible ceasefire in Gaza as the Israeli regime continues its genocidal campaign in the besieged strip.
Hamas officials, who are the main party in this story on behalf of the Palestinian nation, believe that reaching any agreement with Israel is not a real thing in the shadow of the continuation of the killing of women and children. And if the U.S. and Israel are serious about an agreement, they can start dialogue after establishing a ceasefire.
For his part, Haniyeh said that despite all the relentless pressure from Israel, the resistance has remained steadfast on the ground and has managed to inflict heavy losses on the occupying regime.
The military aggression of the Zionist regime against the people of Gaza is unprecedented, and we are witnessing a massive amount of attacks from air, sea, and land against the residents of Gaza. The Zionist regime and its allies thought they could destroy the resistance and that the resistance would be forced to raise the white flag. But after 75 days of mass killings and war crimes by the Zionist regime, the resistance is still firm and steady on the ground and has inflicted heavy losses on the Zionist regime.
The Iranian foreign minister has stated that his visit came following recent developments that show the whole region is seeking a stable ceasefire in Gaza. Experts believe that any end to Israel's genocidal war, which has failed to achieve any of its goals in Gaza, only serves the interests of the Palestinian resistance factions. Reaching a truce, however, won't help the Israeli regime to repair its tarnished image after it lost the international support over the atrocities it committed in the besieged strip. Farzana Ashurian, Doha.
That's it for this hour's bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Yalda, the longest night. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The sunset of the 30th of the Iranian month of Azar marks the longest night of the year. Iranians have been marking this occasion since old times. They call it Yalda. This night is celebrated with recitation of epic poems of Shahnameh or lyric poems of Hafez and Saadi. This is accompanied by eating nuts and fruits. Ancient Iranians believed that on the longest night of the year, the devilish darkness would perish, and they would keep vigil till the sunrise of the next day that marked the first day of winter. They used to light fires till morning. Iranians would get together and enjoy themselves reading poems and recounting stories of the past. The word Yalda is a Syriac word meaning birth and generation. Its connotation can be that of the sun's birth after the longest night. Ancient Iranians maintained that on the night of Yalda, Mitra or Mehr would return to the world and make days longer. Thus, the sun would dominate over the earth once again. Yalda has also been called Shabe Chelle or Chelle night. Chelle derives from Chehel, meaning 40 in Farsi. According to the old text, there were Chelle Bozorg, that is big 40, and Chelle Kuchak, or little 40, that was in fact 20 days. The first 40 days of winter were the big 40, and the next 20 days constituted the little 40. These two periods cover 2 months of winter. Ancient Iranians used to celebrate natural events such as summer revolution or climax of warmth in summer and winter revolution or the climax of cold in winter. Yalda has been marked in Iran till this day. According to the Jalali calendar that began to be used for registering time since 5th century AH, from the first of the Iranian month of day, that is the day following Yalda night, days would become longer, and that meant the death of the demon of cold and birth of the sun. Yalda entered the Iranian calendar since 502 BC during the rule of Dariush the First. The winter revolution is the start of winter, and from then on, the days become longer and longer. This natural event has caused many ethnicities to hold feast. Yalda has been marked from the Great Khorasan up to Kashmir. In Afghanistan, parts of Pakistan, and north of India, Yalda night is called Shabe Chelle Kalan, or the Big 40 night. Tajik people mark this night with customs that resemble those of Iranians very much. The nuts and fruits constitute the main part of Yalda night customs. Women in different parts of Iran make the local pastries for that night. Pistachio, hazelnut, walnut, almond, and so on are the inseparable part of Yalda nuts. Watermelon is also very common on this night. Pomegranate is another fruit of this table. Watermelon and pomegranate are served as they are red, and red is the color of life and vividness. In the past, it was customary to eat snow lumps with grapes juice on Yalda night. Other things that are usual on Yalda night include dried palm, apricot, peach, apple, fig, blackberry, and raisin. As it was said in the beginning of the program, Shahnameh of Ferdowsi and the Divan of Hafez are usually read out by the elderly of the families at the table. customs of Yaldonites have undergone changes throughout centuries. Yet, what is of great significance in this ceremony is the fact that families and relatives gather together in the house of their grandparents and they recount them of the past. Visiting the Eleli and sitting with them is highly recommended in Islam as it keeps the familial bonds firm and helps resolve problems. Moreover, it is a good opportunity for the youngsters to exchange experiences with the elderly and learn many things from them. Familial parties and gatherings have decreased in the West as family and parents have lost their real value and meaning. But Islam puts high emphasis on familial bonds and respect for the elderly and kindness toward the youngsters. Yalda night is a good opportunity to be together, share happiness, and get familiar with each other's problems.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. This is how Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, enlightens us regarding the mission of her father, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Allah has sent Muhammad as perfection for his commands, a resolution to accomplish his rule, and an implementation of the decrees of his mercy. So he found the nations to vary in their faiths, obsessed by their fires, worshipping their idols, and denying Allah despite their knowledge of him. Therefore, Allah illuminated their darkness with my father, Muhammad, uncovered obscurity from their hearts, and cleared the clouds from their insights. He revealed guidance among the people, so he delivered them from being led astray, led them away from misguidance, guided them to the proper religion, and called them to the straight path.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, preserve your faith by avoiding injustice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that the divine punishment awaits those who sin. For every act of an individual is recorded. Yet there are some acts and violations which bring punishment for an individual quicker than other violations. Injustice is such a sin which will be punished quicker than many other sins. The Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, has said, "Indeed, injustice is an evil which brings its punishment most quickly." Out of the different types of people, who is the best of people and who is the worst of people? Sometimes we wonder about this question, right? The Prophet of Allah has said, "The best of people is he who is helpful to people, and the worst of people is he who is harmful to people. Worse than him is he who is respected for fear of his evil." Unjust and oppressive people, according to the Holy Prophet
are the worst of people. Brothers and sisters, this is how Islam looks at human beings. When we look at human being, we see, oh, how much money he has, you know, versus how much money that person has. When we see people, we say, how many cars does he have versus how many cars the other person has, right? This is how we are comparing. Sometimes we look at their academics, sometimes we look at their wealth, sometimes we look at their social status, right? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looks at their being just, how just you are, how much are you practicing on the commands of Allah and Ahlul Bayt. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing preserving our faith by avoiding injustice. We all want to preserve our faith. We know that. You know, everybody, you ask anyone, any random person, do you want to preserve your faith? They would be like, yes, I do want to preserve my faith. One of the conditions in which a person and his faith, in fact, gets lost is when he supports an unjust wrongdoer in any form and shape. This is a very critical issue in Islam. If a person, he's, you know, aiding and supporting an unjust person, this is where he runs into this whole idea of his faith being in risk. The Prophet of Allah said, when a man walks with a wrongdoer to support him, and he knows him to be so, he leaves faith. Right? We may think that since we are doing good to so many people around us, it is okay to do bad to this one believer. Well, this is injustice, and we must avoid it at any cost. Every believer is very dear to Allah. Prophet of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, he who harms a believer will be harmed by Allah, and he who grieves him will be grieved by Allah. Brothers and sisters, don't think that a believer is weak, because as clearly stated, Allah takes revenge of a believer. So if, God forbid, you hurt a believer, if, God forbid, you disappoint a believer, if, God forbid, you are offensive towards a believer, then rest assured, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to stand against you and take the revenge on the behalf of that believer. So brothers and sisters, your wife, your husband, your children, your cousins, your parents, your neighbors, you know, these are the believer people in many cases, right? If you do wrong towards them and the society at large, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to take revenge from you on behalf of those believers.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
They are heroes. Dear child, it is past midnight. I am flying at hundreds of miles an hour in the darkness, thousands of feet over the Atlantic Ocean. I'm traveling to Egypt. I will go to the border of Gaza at Rafah
I go because of you. You have never been in a plane. You have never left Gaza. You know only the densely packed streets and alleys, the concrete hovels. You know only the security barriers and fences patrolled by soldiers that surround Gaza. Planes for you are terrifying. Fighter jets, attack helicopters, drones. They circle above you. They drop missiles and bombs. Deafening explosions. The ground shakes. Buildings fall. The dead. The screams. The muffled calls for help from beneath the rubble. It does not stop. Night and day. Trapped under the piles of smashed concrete, your playmates, your schoolmates, your neighbors, gone in seconds. You see the chalky faces and limp bodies when they are dug out. I am a reporter. It is my job to see this. You are a child. You should never see this. The stench of death, rotting corpses under the broken concrete. You hold your breath. You cover your mouth with a cloth. You walk faster. Your neighborhood has become a graveyard. All that was familiar is gone. You stare in amazement. You wonder where you are. You are afraid. Explosion after explosion. You cry. You cling to your mother or father. You cover your ears. You see the white light of the missile and wait for the blast. Why do they kill children? What did you do? Why can't anyone protect you? Will you be wounded? Will you lose a leg or an arm? Will you go blind or be in a wheelchair? Why were you born? Was it for something good? Or was it for this? Will you grow up? Will you be happy? What will it be like without your friends? Who will die next? Your mother? Your father? Your brothers and sisters? Someone you know will be injured soon. Someone you know will die soon. At night you lie in the dark on the cold cement floor. The phones are cut. The internet is off. You do not know what is happening. There are flashes of light. There are waves of blast concussions. There are screams. It does not stop. When your father or mother hunts for food or water, you wait. That terrible feeling in your stomach. Will they come back? Will you see them again? Will your tiny home be next? Will the bombs find you? Are these your last moments on earth? You drink salty, dirty water. It makes you very sick. Your stomach hurts. You are hungry. The bakeries are destroyed. There is no bread. You eat one meal a day, pasta, a cucumber. Soon, this will seem like a feast. You do not play with your soccer ball made of rags. You do not fly your kite made from old newspapers. You have seen foreign reporters. We wear flak jackets with the word press written on them. We have helmets. We have cameras. We drive jeeps. We appear after a bombing or a shooting. We sit over a coffee for a long time and talk to the adults. Then we disappear. We do not usually interview children. But I have done interviews when groups of you crowded around us, laughing, pointing, asking us to take your picture. I have been bombed by jets in Gaza. I have been bombed in other wars, wars that happened before you were born. I, too, was very, very scared. I still have dreams about it. When I see the pictures of Gaza, these wars return to me with a force of thunder and lightning. I think of you. All of us who've been to war hate war most of all because of what it does to children. I tried to tell your story. I tried to tell the world that when you are cruel to people, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, when you deny people freedom and dignity, when you humiliate and trap them in an open-air prison, when you kill them as if they were beasts, they become very angry. They do to others what was done to them. I told it over and over. I told it for 7 years. Few listened. And now this. There are very brave Palestinian journalists. 50 of them have been killed since this bombing began. They are heroes. So are the doctors and nurses in your hospitals. So are the UN workers, almost 100 of whom have been killed. So are the ambulance drivers and medics. So are the rescue parties that lift up the slabs of concrete with their hands. So are the mothers and fathers who shield you from the bombs. But we are not there. Not this time. We cannot get in. We are locked out. Reporters from all over the world are going to the border crossing at Rafah. We are going because we cannot watch this slaughter and do nothing. We are going because hundreds of people are dying a day, including over 100 children. We are going because this genocide must stop. We are going because we have children, like you, precious, innocent, loved. We are going because we want you to live. I hope one day we will meet. You will be an adult. I will be an old man, although to you I am already very old. In my dream for you, I will find you free and safe and happy. No one will be trying to kill you. You will fly in airplanes filled with people, not bombs. You will not be trapped in a concentration camp. You will see the world. You will grow up and have children. You will become old. You will remember this suffering. But you will know it means you must help others who suffer. This is my hope, my prayer. We have failed you. This is the awful guilt we carry. We tried, but we did not try hard enough. We will go to Rafah, many of us, reporters. We will stand outside the border with Gaza and protest. We will write and film. This is what we do. It is not much, but it is something. You will tell your story again. Maybe it will be enough to earn the right to ask for your forgiveness. Thank you.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Israeli regime's right to defend itself is essentially a license to oppress and kill innocent Palestinians. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Since the events of 7th of October, the assertion that Israel has a right to defend itself has been echoed consistently by media outlets, politicians, commentators, and the general public. The constant mantra of Israel's right to defend itself is incessantly repeated and rarely questioned. It is one of those statements that appears irrefutable to many individuals. Since the establishment of the Israeli regime, this justification has been used to deny Palestinians their right to property, their right to homes, freedom, and most fundamental rights of all. It was used to justify the looting of Palestinian properties after the wars of 1948 and 1967, and to support the imposition of martial law on Palestinians for nearly two decades. The invocation of the alleged right to defend themselves from the resistance of colonized communities has been used by the vast majority of colonizers as justification to carry out their project of eliminating native communities under the settler colonial project. The constant mantra of Israel's right to defend itself is invoked all times, not just by the regime itself, but also by governments in the United States, Europe, Canada, Australia, and many other places. This repetition serves to construct a discourse that conceals the Israeli regime's crimes by portraying itself as an affected party. One could even argue that the Zionist colonial occupation is so pervasive that it usurps the place of the actual victims. By invoking the right to defend itself, Zionism shelters behind a victimhood that doesn't belong to it, merely seeking to conceal its own settler colonial violence. In her book, Se défendre, une philosophie de la violence, philosopher Elsa Dorlin highlights a crucial point about self-defense using the case of Rodney King, a black construction worker brutally beaten by the Los Angeles Police Department on 3rd of March 1991. During the 1992 trial against four police officers accused of assault, every attempt by Rodney King to protect himself from the police was interpreted in court as a threat against the police officers. Any gesture by Rodney King that didn't entail absolute submission to police violence was seen as a risk to police officers' lives. In a broader political analysis, the example of Rodney King represents a historical, legal, philosophical, and political system that legitimizes violence carried out by individuals or entities seen as normative. While condemning the self-defense of those categorized as subaltern, whether they are states, individuals, or organizations, and labeling it as mere aggression. The example of Rodney King represents, at an individual level, a reflection of the colonial model known as preemptive legitimate defense. This deliberate confusion surrounding the concept of the right to defend oneself showcases how, in Palestine, the colonial legal order uses this recourse as a tool to maintain its control. Hence, it's not surprising that the actions of Palestinian resistance groups are labeled as illegal, since they seek to disrupt the colonial status quo. All of this serves to problematize the issue of self-defense, or in other words, for whom is self-defense a right? It shouldn't come as a surprise in attempting to answer the question that historically the right to legitimate violence, including self-defense, is tied to a racial issue. In many cases, this racial division that permits or prohibits violence is disguised behind various signifiers such as the right to property, individual autonomy, and so forth. Philosopher Sylvia Winter explains that Western societies, through imperial expansion and colonial violence, have established a human hierarchy based on racial and consequently legal distinctions. According to the philosopher Sylvia Winter, those perceived as outside the appropriate humanity or lacking legal recognition are stripped of their human status and thus lack legal protection. This dynamic helps understand, for instance, the justification of killings of radicalized individuals in the United States by deeming their presence in places they shouldn't be as a threat. Similarly, this racial construction is used to legitimize the killing of Palestinians by the Israeli regime, including minors, children, by portraying them as a threat. From the racial and normative perspective on the legitimacy of violence as seen in Palestine, the false mantra of Israel's right to defend itself becomes the justification for preemptive war, indefinite detention, constant police surveillance, mass expulsions, and other repressive measures. The Israeli right to self-defense is nothing but the right to perpetuate oppression and the ongoing elimination of the native Palestinian population. From a political and ethical standpoint, the only admissible violence is the one exercised by the colonizer. The self-defense of the colonized should be assessed from a different perspective, as their political and ethical objectives are entirely divergent. The colonial violence and its justification under the guise of the right to defend itself implies upholding a regime of brutality founded on racial division. In contrast, the self-defense of Palestinians involves a struggle to reclaim their humanity and dismantle the racial framework that subjugates them. Therefore, maintaining the fiction that a colonial entity has a right to defend itself is to support, consciously or unconsciously, the racial language and everyday practices of brutality in Palestine.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we consider a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. As the world watches on in the face of Israel's genocidal onslaught against the people of Gaza, one consistent theme which has stood out has been the unbreakable spirit and faith of the Palestinian people. It has led Muslims to look for ways in which they can show their solidarity to the people of Gaza, turning to their religious leaders for guidance. However, when it comes to fulfilling those responsibilities, some Muslim preachers have fallen short, to say the least.
As Muslims look toward scholars, callers to Islam, and academics for guidance on how best to support the people of Palestine, some leaders have been exposed by either their silence or, worse yet, their outright treachery towards the people of Palestine. Take Asim al-Hakim, a Saudi-born Indonesian sheikh. When asked about the concept of Muslims boycotting pro-Israeli businesses, he discouraged the idea, saying that Muslims should leave other Muslims alone and not enjoin the good on them.
So this is a personal preference. If you want to boycott because you feel that it would hurt those who support Israel, good for you. This is your personal way of doing it. But if you see someone not doing it or consuming their cheeseburgers or fried chicken, you cannot blame them and say, oh, shame on you. You're drinking their soft drinks. No, it's not. It's halal.
Or Faraz Hamadi, a former fitness instructor turned social media influencer and preacher based in the USA, who says boycotting Israeli companies is haram unless a Muslim ruler approves it.
Hey, guys, everyone, we should boycott so-and-so company. I had a deal with that company. They're paying us. And when we have a deal together, you're ruining that deal. And it's up to the Muslim government. And you cannot disobey it like that. If the Muslim government or the ruler says boycott, then yes. Because he knows things you don't know. And they have agreements, they have taken care of it. So now he says okay to boycott. And it happened before. But if it doesn't happen now, meaning that we don't know something. It's going to harm us if we boycott them. Yeah? So boycotting, that's why many of the ulama, they said boycotting is haram.
And finally, London-based Shamsi, a pro-Saudi Salafist preacher who appeared on a podcast with Faraz Hamadi, mocking those who have called for boycotting Starbucks in solidarity with the people of Gaza and deflecting with claims about social media links to Zionism.
They're, of course, big multi-million dollar companies like Starbucks and McDonald's and other kind of names.
You know, I love Starbucks, you know. People are driving me crazy. Starbucks. I'm going to hide it.
I don't drink Starbucks, by the way, but you're drinking Starbucks, right? I saw some of your videos, you're holding the cup. I'm like, man, this guy's going to get a lot of heat now.
You don't understand. You know, I'll tell you this funny story, yeah? Someone sent me a message on Instagram, and he said to me, Akhi, do you know that Starbucks is a Zionist supporter? I said, okay. I said, do you know that Instagram, the owner of Instagram, is a Zionist supporter?
These men and many other influencers like them belong to a wing of Salafism referred to sometimes disparagingly as Madkhalism. One core tenet is that Muslims must always obey their leaders, a concept that is generally accepted by some Muslims, but for those influencers, there don't appear to be any particular conditions as to when disobeying those rulers should be prioritized, such as when those leaders are collaborating with Israel.
Joining us today to talk these issues through are two esteemed guests and favorites of the show. With me in the studio is Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who is one of our few honorable scholars that is unapologetic in his Islamic duty of condemning the oppression in Palestine. He graduated from the Islamic Seminary in Qom and lectures in the UK. And joining us on Skype is Brother Shakil Afsar from Birmingham. Shakil is a prominent Kashmiri activist who has tirelessly campaigned against Islamophobia in the UK and abroad, and has consistently championed the Palestinian cause in the mainstream. Thank you to you both for joining us. Sheikh, if I